this might be the solution to all of humanity and Gen Z's problems. We got a dude with a mullet who's going to make it rain. We got people like using microbes to eat petroleum to turn into new. Like, are you kidding me? And like, by the end of this decade, these people are going to be as cool as the actors and actresses of old. Like, we are going to win, and we're going to make technology as cool as it's always deserved to be.
Hello, I'm Ty Morse. This is my conversation with Jason Carman, the head of content at Astranis and the founder and creator behind S3. I hope you enjoy. Okay.
This feels as cool as I would imagine sitting out with Lex would. You're like, you like got a nice tent trail, you look buff, you got cool mics. This feels intense. I love it, dude.
So, you said that you've basically always been a storyteller. What's the first story that you remember telling?
I don't know if it was a story I told, because for a long time, I didn't think I was a very good storyteller. I still don't in many ways. But it's actually stories that my dad would tell me. And now it's not quite what you asked, but my dad would tell me stories when I was little, falling asleep every night. And my dad's like a dentist, a retired dentist, so he has no credential to be a great storyteller, but man, he was brilliant. And he would make these things up on the fly. And like occasionally, if he would notice me being a little restless or falling asleep, he would like ask a question, almost like a choose your own story adventure, like, oh, what should this person do? And then he would like riff off of it. So impressive. But his stories were really fantastical and like so creative, like not your typical like simple story that I would tell if I was in his shoes.
I don't know. He did a great job.
So when you were like 9, I believe, I don't know who got you the camera, but someone got you your first like film camera.
It was a flip video recorder. And I think the first thing I ever made, there's kind of two things that come to mind, but one of them was my English teacher in 5th grade was like, okay, you guys can either write a paper on a book we read, or you can make a video. And I was like, well, I'm not great at writing and I'm lazy at the time. And I don't want to write a paper, so I'll go make a video about it. It was way harder than I thought it would be. But there's this moment when I like made a paper mache like bomb and threw it off the camera, and I was like dressed up in like camouflage and added like a really crappy, like, must have been 16 kilobyte per second, probably even lower, sound effect. And I was just like, that's so cool, movie magic, baby. Threw the ball off the screen and it like blows up.
What was the first movie that you watched where you were like, ooh, you were inspired and wanted to create something similar to it?
Yeah, good question. My parents had a VHS tape setup, and we had like Star Wars 4, 5, and 6 on tape.
Yeah.
I love those movies. Just like that is the epitome of perfect mix of storytelling, special effects, and visual effects. The story isn't even like oh my god, it's like not the best story ever, but those mix between those different things, the world building for its time, obviously, was incredible. And like everyone around me in my life, from like my mom, the local librarian, would just, every time they would see me, would share the story of what it was like to go see Star Wars 4 or 5 in theaters back in like the 70s, I think. And it just like, I felt like I experienced it through them. So like, I really was aware, had this like a very clear sense of how meaningful that was to be
able.
Yeah, and Star Wars specifically. So that was like super impressive to me. And I loved Star Wars as a result. I really like worlds or cinematic universes that like let you escape to another reality. I think that's like the thing that excites me the most. It's the thing I like watching the most.
Who did you look up to at that time, where between like 9/11?
Definitely Steven Spielberg. Yeah, he was my favorite director for a long time.
What did you like about him?
I liked that he didn't go the traditional Hollywood route, and he made his own short films and feature films while he was very, very young. That really inspired me. And him and George, and then that led me to George Lucas eventually. And I was already a fan of Star Wars, but I hadn't like really hyper researched them, and then realized that like George Lucas like made his own visual effects company, which is now the premier visual effects company in the world. And we're like here less than probably 10 miles away from them, ILM. And I got to actually tour ILM when I was really young as well, which was a huge, amazing experience for me here out in the Presidio, where like friend, I think when this girl that I had a crush on, dad's friend worked at Pixar, and he knew someone at ILM. It was like 4 steps removal, but ILM. And then I went to ILM probably around that time and got to see the actual models used for Star Wars, the new ones, the old ones, walk around and see all these people working on some of my favorite movies. And that time they were working on a Transformers movie too. And like, I got, like, I kind of heard that's what they're working on. I was like,
this is where I want to work. I want to, not here, but like, I want to be a visual effects artist. And this is about the time I finally am like, probably like 11 or 12 or 13, beginning to get good at like motion and After Effects and certain things like that. And I'm like, I want to do visual effects. And in realizing that like George Lucas like built that company from scratch, that started to plant the seed of like the idea that it's like, no, it's not just cool to make movies. You have to like make movie companies. That's cool. But not, again, not just like studio heads running and like throwing money at things, but like the creatives and the executives either being the same person or in super alignment with like their goal and their interests.
How'd you learn to do CGI?
Video Copilot, Film Riot, Freddie Wong, Brandon GLA, Quarter Digital. I think you just named everyone of early significance that I learned from. But yeah, it was like early YouTube, YouTube University. I was like, I take great pride in being a YouTuber today. I never thought I actually would be. And this leads me to Andrew Price tutorials. This is probably like 2013. And I started learning Blender before it like gets its like beautiful redesign into 2.8 and the UI is all pretty. It was like just this raw 3D software, but it was open source and free. And like the industry kind of like hated it at the time. And it was just like, this is not serious software. Today, it's actually used by a ton of like legit agencies and like shops. And like, it's at least installed in everyone's machine because you need it to convert between file formats. Blender's amazing. And like, you know, any future film company I build will use Blender as its 3D software. We won't use anything else. Blender's amazing. But I basically through YouTube and then trial and error. But like specifically CGI, like some of the first CGI I did was, I did a bunch of sci-fi stuff, like comping in shots of like spaceships flying around, 3D tracking them into shots I filmed in my local park where I like run cross country and stuff. And then I made like a short film in 2014 that like won best visual effects out of like 4,000 entrants. And it was like number one best visual effects out of a like all American high school film festival or something.
Really?
I wasn't even gonna enter it. But then my mom was like, enter it. You made the film, just enter it. I'm like, no. And it was like, okay, you're right. And so I entered it and won. And I was like, whoa. And that got me like a full ride scholarship to college and all sorts of cool stuff that I didn't take advantage of, but like I got it, which was cool.
When you were like, I think in middle school and high school, you actually like got paid to create films,
yeah, and
like content for people.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I probably like made about, I would guess around 40 or 60 grand by the time I graduated.
What was the first deal that you, like someone offered you money?
It's probably in seventh or eighth grade and someone's probably friend's parent had a friend who had a business and needed photos or video or something. It was all small stuff like that. Occasionally like little bigger things from more serious companies and it would just go right back in the gear.
Yep.
Which now I a little bit regret. I'm like, yeah, there's some stuff I bought. I think I didn't know what I didn't know. Or like directly back into like, I'm making a short film.
Yeah. How did you like advertise that you were willing to make films for people?
I think it's sort of like people just like knew the friends of mine or friends of friends that like, oh yeah, it's Jason. He's like the film kid. He like can film and do photos and videos and stuff. And so I never asked anyone. It was mostly people coming to me and basically being like, oh, I have this need. Can you do it? That would help. And then, you know, the more stuff I made, the more people would hear about it and see it. Yeah. So it wasn't really an attempted business for me. I didn't like try and like, I was never like, this is my business or like, I was just like, I need money to pay for the things I need to make the stories I want to tell. How do I, you know, and then like it would work out.
Was it during college that you created Joyride Studios or?
This brings up a good point. Well, I didn't go to college. So
okay. Basically
watching Film Riot in like sixth grade and Ryan Connolly is like, you do not need to go to film school. I was like, really? And then I kind of looked at my work and I was like, okay, random man on the internet, don't really trust you. No offense. But I like did some research and I was like looking at my current stuff at the time. I had a really cool visual effects short film, music videos. I'd done some cool stuff. It was only in sixth grade. And then I looked at like average portfolios of senior graduates from like legit film schools. Not from like master's programs, but like undergrad film. And I was like, my work is better almost than everyone's here at my age. Like at that time.
Great. Yeah.
I think things have changed a bit. But I was like,
with the tools available.
Well, because basically I just got lucky about having access to these digital tools that I had access to. And when these kids graduating, like only had like their transition was from actual film to DV tape stuff. And I never really had to work with DV tape, like ever. I was fully digital. So I had an insane advantage. And then like the kids that are graduating right now, most of their portfolios are actually still pretty bad. But overall, there's way more tutorials and knowledge that you can make beautiful stuff easier than ever before. So there was a huge advantage there. And like I had the internet, like, it's a huge part of my life. It's just like being lucky, like 5 years earlier,
I wouldn't have had as much access. In 10 years, I wouldn't have as much access to the internet. And it had like a huge, 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 like, that's why my work was so much better than like college graduates at that time. And I looked at that and I was like, yeah, no fucking way I'm going to film school. Like, my work is better. And so like, I would just be like the kid in class and at school and like at home be like, I'm not going to college. I'm not going to college. And then eventually by eighth grade, I'm like, this isn't great. Cause like, that's not a great thing to say to people. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, I'll go to college maybe. But my plan was like, okay, I'll make a feature film and win an Oscar by age 16.
Really?
I really thought I could do this.
When did you set this goal?
Probably like when 14? I was 15. Yeah, 15? 14 or 15.
Okay.
It was very...
Win an Oscar by 16.
Honestly, it might have been 12 or 13. But I was like, and why? Because I wanted to prove to my parents that I didn't need to go to film school. And I was like, well, if I win an Oscar, that'll do it. Obviously, that didn't happen. Got even nowhere close to achieving the goal. It wasn't like I just thought it would happen. I was like, yeah, I'll figure it out. It'll happen, but pretty silly. But I was making a bunch of short films and stuff. And realized by junior year, senior year, I was like, man, wait, school's really cool. Like, most of my school experience was like trying to minimize it in homework. Not so I could party or hang out with people. It was like, so I could go home and edit. Like, I used to have like a pretty insane ability to like pull like very, very little amount of sleep, do like cross country or track that I was kind of forced to do, but I kind of liked it. And then spend the rest of the time editing and filming things like evenings and weekends. I had like recruited a bunch of people to help me like film stuff, like actors, crew members who were my friends. And like, we're making movies like constantly. Like, we made 20, 30 short films by the time we graduated high school. And this was like a little village.
It's like prolific.
Yeah, I was like, it was basically like I built a cult of people to make films. I really didn't like school most of my life until I started this semester at like a community college. And oh my God, I fell in love with learning. Like, I was like, phew.
What was the change? What did you love so much?
It was total. It was like illusion of free will that like made it interesting. And then also I found it really just genuinely interesting. And I fell in love with it. And then I got a job from like 2K Games, which is a video game company.
Yep.
And my first manager ever there, Kenny, took like a huge chance on me solely because he was like, I like that you didn't go to school and you have like obviously talent and skill. And if my kids have talent and skill, I don't want them to have to go to school one day. So he like took this bet on me and it paid off for him and me. But when I got there initially, it was just like edit. And like, I really worked quite hard and like deeply cared about it. And so my manager kind of kept giving me more responsibility until eventually like, you know, the announced trailer, which is like the big kind of way that you kick off the, so NBA 2K is like this yearly franchise of a game that 2K has. It's the second biggest sports game in the world. And every the kind of kickoff for the new cycle for it of the game being released is like the announced trailer. And so Kenny was like, you know, do you want to direct kind of and lead the announced trailer? And I was like, what does that mean? And he's like, you kind of come up with the concept for it and like lead some of the motion capture artists on the dev team to capture shots the way you want them captured and then edit it. You pick the music, you edit it, you make it good. And I was like, no clue why you're giving me this responsibility, but like, okay, deal. And I was really inspired by like the cinematography in the Humble music video by Kendrick Lamar, where like you have the RoboCam moving around with high motion blur. So I was like, why haven't we ever done that before for a game capture? It's like, you could easily do it. You just hit, like get a shot of someone dunking, cameras from behind him, pause it, and then you swivel the camera around him, hit resume on the game again, and then it looks like this cool stop motion, like Matrix effect. And so we did that. And the motion capture artists were like, this is so stupid. But I was like, trust me. And it's still the most viewed NBA 2K announced trailer of all time. And like, what's interesting is like at the time, and I constantly, at the time, I wasn't sure if people understood, if like the average consumer or viewer could tell the difference between like good quality stuff and like exceptional, like artistic, like some effort was put into it. I didn't really know if people could tell. And I now fully believe that actually people can sense it way more than you'd expect. But people like in the comments were like, wow, it's like the best 2K trailer of all time. And I was like, this is just like, they're just excited for this year. But they weren't talking about the game. They were talking about the trailer edit. But I was like, really? Like, I was like, whoa, we put an extra effort into these types of camera shots, into this editing, and people noticed and cared about it. And it made me realize like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then there was this day where like my coworker, Evan, was like, oh, did you see what Ronnie posted? And I was like, who's Ronnie? He's like, Ronnie 2K, of course. And I was like, who's Ronnie 2K? And he showed me this guy's Instagram. At the time, he had like maybe 300,000 followers. And I was like, oh my God. He's like, who is this? He's like, it was this tall, like
dude that works here. And I was like, he works here? So yeah, he's like an influencer. That wasn't even a word yet in the nomenclature. Like that, you were not an influencer in 2019, really. I guess it was just trying to become a term. And so like one of the stories that Ronnie had basically been around at 2K for 15 years. It was like the lowest job you can get at 2K, which is like a community forum manager. And social media didn't even exist when he started. Twitter didn't exist, Instagram didn't exist, Facebook didn't exist. And as these social media started coming out, he would just take pictures with the athletes at the parties. So like, you know, they host these big like parties every year for the announcement of the game. And like the cover athletes come, like famous NBA players, he would take pictures of them every year. And then after a few years, he like changed his profile name to like Ronnie 2K, and he became known as like Ronnie 2K. And so then like after doing this for just a few years, he becomes like the internal and external brand ambassador for 2K with like the players. And then like as 2K gets bigger, they start like bringing in like soundtrack, like hip hop soundtrack. They start bringing in like clothing collaborations, and like he becomes sort of the ambassador between the company, the game, and the culture. So now, like when I start 2019, he's got a million followers on Twitter, like almost. I have like 300,000, he has like 300,000 on Instagram. And he's like basically kind of at this like pretty bubbly famous point. Like anyone that knows the NBA 2K game pretty much knows him. They're even putting him in the game now, like as like in the like campaign scenes.
Yeah.
Like he's like a character in it. It's pretty wild. I go in the bathroom, I'm on my phone stalking him. Going number two. Then I opened the door and he's there washing his hands. And I was like, I was so tempted to just turn around and be like, look, it's you. But I didn't know him that well. Ronnie has a dark sense of humor like I do. So like actually probably would have thought that was funny if he knew me, but we didn't. And then a few weeks later, Ronnie like needed someone to film the behind the scenes of his motion capture shoot for that year's appearance in the game. And he asked my manager, who asked me to go and do it. So I came with him and did it. And I think, and like I filmed him. And like Ronnie kept asking me to do stuff. And then eventually was like, hey, like I want, you know, Jason to come and like do all of my coverage and behind the scenes stuff at like that year's release party.
Yeah.
So I got to go to this release party, and it was like truly a Hollywood release party. It was like famous like rap and pop artists, like a ton of famous NBA players. Like, and it was like truly just a like Hollywood moment. And I got to like see and interact with all these famous people and like take their picture with Ronnie. I brought a cool 3D film camera and the Sheikah. It was all this cool stuff. And then, basically from that moment on, Ronnie was like kind of abducted me to be his like content guy.
Personal content guy?
Yeah. So during kind of like 9 months into 2K, 6 months into it, my friends from back home, some friends are like making a rap album, but it's surprisingly good. Anyways, I make this music video, Splash. It's also one of the few things. It's like, obviously I look back at something like Splash or Vacuum Wars, and I have like a lot of things like, oh, this obviously sucks and I would do it differently. But I've learned as a creative, I don't actually buy into this whole idea that it's like as a creative, you'll look back and hate everything you've ever done. It's not really true. You only hate it if you know you left something on the bench. If you really like left it all out there on the court, like in the effort.
Gave it your all for the time that you had at the time. Yes.
Perfect. If you do that, like you will not regret it. Yeah, you'll look at it and you'll cringe a little bit. But like overall, you'd be like, I did that. And that's how I feel about Vacuum Wars and Splash. And like a few weeks after, like it kind of like went mini viral. I also like paid some like accounts on Instagram to promote it for the group. And then they're like, oh my God, it's going viral. And I was like, because I paid someone $50 to repost it. But it worked. And like some, like randomly I got a message from like an executive at a music label. And they're like, hey, I work at like this big music label. And I was like, wow. They're like, we want you to make a music video for one of our artists. Like, look at our roster and pick one. I was like, okay. Now, looking back, this is not how this normally goes.
How does it normally go?
Normally, an artist has a bid out for a music video because the label's like, we need to make a music video for X single. Single's coming out and you bid to a bunch of directors. You never like go to a creative and say, pick someone from a roster to work with. That's totally weird. And so like looking back on it, I'm like, that was strange.
And I just like really like what you had done.
I don't know. I would assume so. Some of these artists were small, so like wouldn't have been too crazy for them to like connect us. But some of them were huge. Like one of them was Charlie Puth. And I'm not sure like Charlie Puth would have agreed to work with me, but like he was on that list. And there was a few other big people. And so it was like, so I picked like, in retrospect, in some ways, I'm like, maybe I should have picked Charlie Puth. I don't know. Or like some other like famous person. But I picked the one that I liked like the music the most on the list. At the time, that was Rico Nasty, who was at a female rap artist that is just like, to this day, I love her and her music, and
Yeah. I like her music is just great workout music. It's great angry music. It's awesome. And that led to me directing a music video for her and an artist she featured with for like an upcoming album she was going to release called Nightmare Vacation. And I put my foot into this video. Oh my God. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to like leave CK and become like a big music video director. And that will lead me to being George Lucas and making sci-fi films. Bad plan, but it was my plan. And I left like 2K, like January of 2020, February of 2020, was $0 basically. Moved to Los Angeles and finished up this video. And all of a sudden the label and one of the artists, the feature artists, just like weren't really happy with the video. It was really, and at the time, like really hurt. And like, I really tried to make it right and do a bunch of iterations. And like, I just like, they didn't like it. And like, they dropped the video. They never released it. Which is sad because this video is better than Splash. And they basically, everyone saw Splash, the artist, the feature artist, and the label. And they're like, we worked that for a new song. And I did it, and I did it better. But something didn't click. Either I upset someone on set, or they just didn't like the way they looked, or fill in the blank reason. But like, they killed the video, basically. It was really sad because like, I ended up losing money on it. They didn't fully pay like the entire contract out. And I had no money. And then
you like poured your heart and soul.
Yeah, I left 2K thinking that like this was going to like blow up even more than Splash did. Did this, and this was going to go like this, and then lead me to even more, and I was going to be making tons of money as a music video director in Los Angeles. And now the video's not even coming out. I have $0, and then COVID hits, and everything shuts down. And I'm like, and basically what gets me through COVID is I. Still through that created a good relationship with Rico and her manager, and like we really liked each other, and I would just go to their studio sessions a lot and just like edit stuff for like little photos or videos for social or whatever, just there. And eventually like I pitched this like idea for an album cover to them. Like retrospect, I'm like, it's kind of a bad album cover, it's kind of not, it's kind of good. I go back and forth on this.
How would it be good or bad?
If you're making something repetitively, like in this case albums, you kind of want the vibe of them to sort of like feel synchronous. And this like was a bit maybe too much of a departure from her other album art. It's a really cool concept. It's just a little bit too, I don't know. I just don't like it that much. It's like too colorful. It's like too saturated. It's like a little too much maybe. Yeah. I don't know. That's my take on it. I could be wrong. Some people liked it, I think. And so they're like, basically like, we like it. We're going to get the label to pay for it. And the label like offers to pay me more money for that single freaking image. It was already done than the previous video, moreover. And I was like, what? And so then, whatever. That was crazy to me.
Was it like $20,000 or something like that?
It was only 10.
It was 10.
But to me, it was like, what?
It was
for
a
single image, one image, 10. And I was like, oh my God. It was insane to me. And so I became kind of for like pseudo creative director for like a year, give or take. So I filmed other music videos that did get released. We filmed one in COVID that like got featured in some articles because it was like the first ever remote music video is shot. It was pretty cool. And like we did that. I did a few other music videos for her. I like made her album trailer, made some merch. And like through that experience, I realized that like the music industry was not a good fit for me.
Yeah.
Nor I for the music industry. And it's really unhealthy overall. Like a lot of people are like have problems. Like a lot of drug and alcohol usage, like way more than normal in a professional industry. And like also just the label, like most label people I met in that during that experience were really not great people. And so I left it. I was like, I'm leaving this. Went back to 2K. So that was kind of music video experience.
What was the process of going from doing Joyride, going back to 2K?
So yeah, I went back to 2K. Well, actually in interim, I became Ronnie's business manager randomly.
What did that involve?
Like deal flow, which like actually like I started to make some headway on and was like learning to do pretty well, but like it was not a good fit for me. And I was like, okay, let me be your brand manager. You should hire me back. The whole time Ronnie was like, let me hire you full time to like do all my brand and content stuff. And I was like, no, I want to go make music videos. And then I was like, okay, I want to go back to you. And he was like, all right, cool. And we had a lot of fun. Went back, basically went really full time with Ronnie, helping grow his brand, create content for him. Be like, blew up his TikTok and his Instagram and like took him from, I think he probably had 2.5 or 3 million followers and like ended like after
9 months of working together, probably like close to five, which isn't just like I did all that. It's like a lot of algorithmic was already going that direction, but we did a good job of like looking at certain trends and making content to like grow on top of it and like really thinking a lot like about his brand and like how do we make the story more positive. For example, like if you're a 2K fan or if you're not a 2K fan, like, you know, pretty much like any product, especially a consumer product, like people hate parts of it for certain reasons. And NBA 2K definitely, for a variety of reasons, is hated by some people, or like parts of it are hated. And I actually don't think it's any singular person or entity or team at 2K's fault at all. It's just like, it's all a mix of things. Like my personal opinion is that, like, you know, consumers these days are very spoiled and want certain things. And like, yeah, like maybe certain things that like the 2K did with their product, like probably weren't in the best interest of the consumer. Like they got angry with that, whatever. Point being though, it's rare that you get to take all of your consumer hatred and put it against a person. You see this with Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg sometimes, but Ronnie got treated like that. Mm-hmm. Like Ronnie, like anything that 2K or NBA 2K did wrong or perceived as wrong, they just attributed to Ronnie. They're like, it's your fault, Ronnie, which is insane because he's literally just an influencer. He doesn't make the game, all this stuff. And I remember the 2020 game got released and people were really unhappy with this like feature or whatever. And they signed a petition, like they created an online petition to like fire Ronnie 2K because he didn't deliver on the game. And he got 50,000 signatures. Whoa. In like 2 weeks. Imagine you have a job that you love and you like care deeply about the community, the game, the company, and then people create a petition to fire you. It's like, I was like, gosh, I felt so bad for him. And like what I learned from Ronnie was thick skinned. Like, oh my, like you couldn't, I'm sure it did. Like all these negative comments with things like impact him, but he did such a good job of like handling it and not internalizing it and like understanding that like people will be people. And so I say this because going into like really being his kind of brand manager, like there were optics problems. Like people really didn't like him for a variety of reasons. Some, like most of the time, not his fault. Sometimes, like, yeah, a little bit of this is his fault. Like, for example, like, you know, people would be like, oh, like the virtual currency in the game is too expensive. And then like Ronnie, we post like a picture of Ronnie with like a McLaren that like the car company like gave to him for a rental because they like wanted his like him to take a picture with it. And like that optic is not good. And so like, yeah, mistakes were made. But overall, like I was like really like, okay, how can we make his brand more authentic and like connect him? Like, how can we like show people who Ronnie really is to like open that up more? And I think we had some decent success with that and like played off of some things and like helped grow his brand. I ended up leaving 2K in, I think January of 2022 or three. Yeah. But I mentioned, I like started learning about ad agencies and I never heard about ad agencies before and I got really interested in them. And so I serendipitously on a trip in New York, I bought this book called The Copy Book. Mm-hmm. And it was like basically about great copywriting from ad agencies. I just fell in love. I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. It's like psychology and writing and creativity mixed. This book is amazing and ad agencies are amazing. And there was like two agencies I was like really interested in like working at. And I like reading behind the scenes, I was like, oh, it's going to take like a decade to get hired here. Like 5 or 6 years to get hired here. And like, I got to like put in the hours. And so like, oh. And so like I applied to an agency just like as a crappy intern position, even though it was like, you know, technically below my skill level. And they tracked my application up way higher. They like took it and they're like, we're actually going to put you, like, we're going to create a new role for you.
Really?
And I was like, what? And they're like, yes. Like, we want you to be full creative producer here. Take the vision that you wanted to do at 2K, that like create internal in-house production for a company, and do that here. And I was like, and this is my dream agency. This is TBWA, Shy at Day. This was Apple's ad agency until recently, until Apple got so big, they're like, we're going to make our own. Not only my dream job, I thought I would get this job for 5 years. Like,
and you were getting it now.
I was getting it now. I was getting it with more money than I expected. And they were going to give me like a team of two people to like help, basically.
Yeah.
And I was so excited to take the offer. And then I had a second round interview at Astranis.
Yeah.
And it was with Mickey, our VP of Ops, who the role was going to report directly to at the time. And she like charmed me, honestly. She and Christian actually separately charmed me. And I was just like, in this moment, I had this like moment where it's like three things like clicked with me. One was, I didn't realize that people didn't have access to affordable internet, 3.5 billion people. And I didn't really mention this, but like my uncles who were like tech gurus were also trying to build like a rural fiber network.
Really?
Independently, like without any contracting or like help, which is insane. This is like before Google even built their first one. And so, and so like they campaigned for Google, like Google was like doing a campaign. They're like, prove to us why we should build fiber in your city. And like they did a whole street parade and fair to like Google come here. And then I think they went to Phoenix anyway, which makes more sense. So they're like, fine, we'll build it ourselves. And so they started to build it and they got a bunch of money from the California Public Utilities Commission. It was super inspiring. And then my uncle passed away, who was trying to do this. And his spouse, continued on and has actually moved the project farther since. But this is a huge impact on me. They drugged me to like some telco conferences when I was like 12 or 13, which like as a 12 or 13 year old, there's cool conferences and not cool conferences. A telco conference isn't that fun. Like going to NAB where they have cameras, or like a space symposium where I was this week where they have like rocket engines, pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Telco conference is mostly just panels talking about like fiber connectivity and LTE, which ironically are really interesting things to me now. So I had like a weird amount of knowledge about the telco industry in that interview and realized how important Astronis' value prop versus other offerings like traditional geo or Starlink was, and realized that 3.5 billion people didn't have internet once Mickey told me that. And then three, realized that if I didn't have internet, I wouldn't have the skills I had today.
Because you went to YouTube during university.
Right.
Exactly.
Where would I be? And then it like hit me like a, you know, strike of lightning that like a bolt of lightning that half the world doesn't have internet. This is half of our species just isn't able to potentially live up to their full potential, which is really heartbreaking. And like just, you know, incredibly unfair. Internet is a utility. Actually, I would argue it could be more important than other utilities because it's like an enabler for so much more. Internet prevents war because now you can like, if atrocity is happening, you can film it, you can share it, you can ask for help, you can get help, you know, access government services, medical services, job opportunities, education, connecting with people. I mean, like Gen Z, millennials a little bit, but Gen Z is like defined by the internet and that half of the world didn't have it. And that there's just no, in my mind, viable way to connect the other half of the world affordably to it. It's like, whoa. And then the fact that, you know, Astronis is based in San Francisco and they have no marketing department, they're basically like, come and build it for us. I was like, all right, and I'm going to do this instead. And I remember like basically making the decision to turn down the offer from Shiat Day, which I was like really sad about because it was like a dream job.
It was like a huge thing.
Yeah, you know? I was like terrified I was going to regret it. And I assumed I would probably regret it a few times. There hasn't been a single second
that you regret it.
That I've regretted it since joining Astronis. This has been like,
that's just fantastic.
Yeah.
So you have this amazing job offer to go work with this advertising agency. Yeah. But you also, for whatever reason, had those interviews with Astronis. Why did you decide to like even apply?
Well, this is like 4 weeks of just like intense applications. I think I did 200 applications and had
100.
Yeah. When I do something, I really do it. Hardcore. Especially with numbers. Yeah, you gotta do it. Same all your options. So I had like probably 20 plus interviews from that month long process. So I really got to pick my favorite, you know, companies. And so it was like already happening basically. So by the time I got the job offer, I was like second or third round interview with Astronis. And then this is a testament to Christian and his hiring ability. And I like remember getting the offer letter from Shiat Day. And then I was like, oh my God, I got the offer letter, but like, I really want to get one from Astronis too. My parents were like, round two interview. You have to do a third round interview and then film on site and then do a panel interview where you can get an offer. Like, that's a long time. And I was like, I have a feeling it's not. And I had a feeling it's not gonna be a long time because I could just tell Christian was a crackhead like me. And I did my third round interview with Christian and he immediately was like, do you want to come and film tomorrow? And I was like, yes. And I was like, then came to film tomorrow. He's like, do you want to do a panel interview the same the next day? And I was like, yes. And then like by the day after that, I had an offer letter. So like it like testament to Christian's ability to move fast and not do like typical company thing. It's just like, we're gonna give it a few days before we ask you for an on-site, or we're gonna give you a few days before we get back to you. Like they were just go. That's just startup mentality and like move fast and like, yeah.
What were the first like few months at Astronis like?
By the end of my first full week at Astronis, I had been in a remote part in Alaska longer than I had been in the office at the company, by like double. Like show up to Astronis my first day on a Wednesday. End of the day, my boss at the time, Mickey, was like, you want to go to Alaska next week? And I was like, do you have a choice? And she's like, well, not really. But like, you know, do you want to go to Alaska and film the setup of some of our carrier monitoring sites, which are kind of like health antennas for the satellite? I was like, yeah, let's do it. So I went and did that. And it was cold, wet, intense conditions. I freaking loved it. It was awesome. We're getting to film antennas in the Alaskan wild. wasn't really that wild. It was like right near Ketchikan, but still, it was cold and the weather was intense. So there's a good amount of traveling. And early on, the first 3 months of Astronauts is really just like throwing every dart at the wall. Like we tried basically, we actually called it Operation Fowl, which was secret code for Operation Shotgun, because that felt a little aggro at the time. And I was like, new company, I don't want to like give off gun vibes. That's weird. The idea was like throw a bunch of ideas at the wall, see what sticks. But not sticks externally. That's too short of a time frame to tell if something's going to work externally, but to see if it felt right with us, like myself, Mickey, Christian, John, the company. And so we did like all sorts of different things. We did like kind of cutesy, like meet Astronauts, like what's your favorite Starbucks drink? Like ask that to a person. Doing like this series I really like that one day I think Astronauts should bring back called Rocket Scientists React, where we have our engineers react to movies, TV shows, real missions, et cetera. I think it's an awesome series. And then like kind of engineering vlogs. And then we realized that that's the alpha. And then around like a year later, we realized that actually just general educational videos from the lens or angle of like an aerospace company is huge. And so now we're like really about to lean into that, which we already have, but like even more so. So the first 2 months were about like kind of figuring out like what's important. Cause like the goal was like, Astronauts was like, didn't exist publicly really. Very weird website, not a lot of renders. It was a secret. And like, a year after I kind of shut up and just started videoing everything, it's like many more people know about Astronauts, have heard about it, I've seen it. And now like we're about to kind of finish final polishes on not a rebrand, but like a brand polish. And that will make everything look, you know, good and like really professional and make it look like we've raised as much money as we have and have stuff in orbit. And then, you know, that the full Astronauts brand kind of upgrade will be done and it'll look legit.
Yeah, it's been very impressive to me because like I kind of feel like with hard tech companies, you have to, part of the job and a big part of the job, especially for like attracting talent, is be able to evangelize what you are doing in such a way that people actually get excited about it and they just like naturally hear about it through the course of surfing social media and stuff.
Yes.
And you guys are doing that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, like, you know, we have people at Astronauts who are incredibly good at that. Like Christian and Mickey are like prime examples. I told you, it was like a second round interview. I'd never seen the office. I didn't know it looked like this. Most offices don't look like this.
No.
And they just sold me on the idea through person to person sharing the story. But when I first started, average applicants to an Astronauts role for about 200 per role, 200 people applied. Now it's like over 1,200.
Well,
and almost all of them cite, like actually 98%, cite the videos. Some people even like find Astronauts through the YouTube algorithm and then go to apply for jobs, which is so cool. And now almost every new hire we have here like kind of brings it up, and it's like makes me very, very emotional. Like it's very meaningful. Go direct.
I would be super curious. So I've seen, like, before we even get into S3, you have been able to build S3 while working at Astronauts.
Yeah.
How does that dynamic work? Because I didn't even realize I did not know what Astronauts did. And then I'm watching S3 and I'm like, this is awesome. And I look at you and you're like, okay, so you're doing S3. This is awesome. But you're working at Astronauts. And then Christian is also working at Astronauts while he's doing First Principles.
Right.
How does this dynamic work?
Well, I sort of didn't think too much about starting S3 because I actually didn't. On the one hand, I was like, oh, this is going to be huge. On the other hand, I was like, this isn't going to be that big of a deal. Because I started S3 initially very selfishly. I was like, I want to learn more about other deep tech companies that aren't Tesla and SpaceX, like meaning just massive companies. Like I want to learn about the ones that no one knows about yet. Like, okay, basically it was like this theory that like, okay, if Astronauts is amazing, raised all this money, has this big space and no one knew about it, there's got to be other companies like that. Or even like, you know, with a few conference room size of a space that no one knows about and they just don't have any content people yet. And so it was like, the only way you can really find out about deep tech startups, it's like look through VC's websites, portco listings, or like he's talking around town or being on Twitter. And there aren't, you know, no one's doing videos in these companies yet until they like feel more real. And so I was like, that's lame. I'm just going to do, and I was like working out and I was like, someone should do like a weekly
Someone should do like a weekly documentary series on like these cool deep tech companies. And as soon as the thought in my brain, I was like, shit, I have to do it. Yeah. I didn't even want to. It was not a choice. It was just like, I had the thought and was like, there's no one else that's going to do this. I need to do it.
Is that the best reason for doing something?
Yeah.
No one else is going to do it. It needs to be done.
It needs to be done. But in doing these episodes, I, you know, realized that this was like basically what Ronnie was doing at 2K. Except like Ronnie's basically just taking pictures of himself and like, you know, going viral because of the NBA players in them and like then eventually creating his own content. I was creating documentaries, but it was stealing attention share from companies and people we have no right stealing attention share to for a satellite company. And so it's an influencer marketing play. Like people often like ask the wrong question. Like they're like, what is the strongest thing about you doing S3? And it's like, this is very calculated. Like we're every time that like, S3 or first principles gets a follow, so does Astronis.
That's the way
it's literally just influencer marketing. And so it's like, it's very tactical in that sense. And also it's becoming more popular that you're seeing people being their own brands that aren't just founders or executives at companies. This is becoming much more popular, like especially in technology. It's going to only go more that direction, especially now that we're moving more and more to this sort of social media internet economy where attention can actually be traded. Like, right? There's different currencies beyond just monetary. Persona and audience and brand is going to matter. It matters a whole lot now, but it's going to matter even more in the future. And so like companies should, for the most part, with people that they trust and have good relationships with, be okay with people doing things. As long as they're, at the end of the day, like I will blow S3 up if it affects my work at Astronis, right? Like for example, today we shipped the main episode for S3 today versus yesterday because I chose to take more time for work this past week than the episode. That happens all the time. And like, you know, just got to know your priorities.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I would like to talk about the what your initial mission for S3 was for the first like 10 episodes.
Originally it was selfish. Like I just wanted to meet other like deep tech founders and get to talk to them and ask them questions. And share their stories too. It was also a little bit like I wanted to help them because some companies like a lot of the companies in the future are so busy building as they should be that like they don't, aren't going to make time to tell their stories. And like they'll realize that like actually that it's really helpful to do so when it comes time to raise. And so like S3 has helped so many companies raise because like they get a good video and then like the either our audience hears about it, there's a lot of investors in it, or they just send it to an investor and be like, oh, like you don't have time to come take a walkthrough or meet me. Here's the video. And like the videos are designed to feel very authentic and like you just got a tour from the founder. And so it's helped, which is really
it awesome. Makes everything look a lot more real.
Yeah, you could see it, you could feel it. And even if it's just as simple as just like, it's just the person talking in the corner of their like office that's not even an R&D space, it feels more real than like a call sometimes. So there's that. And then episode 4, it was the first time I traveled for the show. And I traveled like to Los Angeles where I filmed with Gundo before it was even Gundo really. Like Rangeview, Varda. What else did I film with on that trip? Ambercycle, that was cool. Cover. Yeah, I went there and like I remember filming with Varda, like kind of editing it. And I was hanging out with my friend, Maxi. And I was like thinking about S3. And I was just like, I was kind of a lightning moment where I was like, much like how most of society, half of the society doesn't have internet, that's half of humanity that isn't optimized with internet. That's half humanity that might not be operating at their most optimized, their best because of this lack of a utility.
Highest leverage.
Yeah. Right. And so I realized that when I joined Astronis, I didn't think that I could keep up with like a rocket scientist or a spacecraft or aerospace engineer. Then after working here, after honestly just working at Astronis for a few months, I realized like, actually, I'm way more similar to these people than I ever thought. And if I gave it 6 months or a year or two of just dedicated focus on any really hard technical thing, you can like get to expert level knowledge pretty quickly. Not like research level necessarily, but even then, it's just a few extra years. It's not that hard. And so I realized this and I kind of had like a mind-blowing moment where I was like, wow, like, yeah, I didn't realize this. This is like a special experience for me when I joined Astronis. And then as I start making these documentaries and sharing with family and friends and like random people on Twitter are seeing them, I'm like, whoa, people are doing that? And then I realized that like, oh my gosh, a huge percentage of society might not realize that they too can go like build the future in deep tech, whether it's founding, doing research, or just like working at one of these companies, whether you're a spacecraft engineer or you work like at a business ops or facilities, you're like actively enabling a deep tech company to build the future. And I realized that like, this might be the solution to all of humanity and Gen Z's problems. Here is like inspiring more people to realize that they can actually go and be a part of that.
Yeah.
And this idea that you don't just have to work a marketing job, you don't just have to work a finance job or in consulting or whatever fill in the blank kind of like stereotypical
generic
societal job. If you want to do it, cool. But like, I think most people, if they like really actually understood how they literally could go and do anything they wanted to, might relook at life a little bit. And I mean, like, it's one thing to say like you can be anything you want, but very few people actually realize that that means you could go work on spaceships or that you can go fill in the blank, build planes or build jetpacks.
And the other thing is people have to have examples of others that are actually doing it. That's part of why like the power of SpaceX is so important.
And yes.
They're basically saying to the entire world, you can do this kind of thing.
Totally.
Which, yeah.
And I think like that's one of my favorite things about S3 is like, it's one thing for like, you know, big press and big podcasts to cover the most popular startup or talk to SpaceX, but they've already made it. And so S3 is kind of, you know, we're trying to find startups that you haven't heard of yet. Which like is not a great growth strategy, but I don't really care. For example, I think of the guys who are making jetpacks, ExoVolar. They're like young 20 somethings making freaking jetpacks. And I think of other people that are just young on S3 and have a lot of care and passion about a thing. But like you talk to these people and you watch them talking, like these are pretty like average normal humans. Like they're not like necessarily, not every single one of them is like a crazy super genius. And like that's like kind of the goal is to show that more. Honestly, the goal of an S3 was just to show the founder and the startup in like an unfiltered light. Yeah, correct. But also showing like, hey, you're way more similar to these founders than you'd ever expect. And like, I'm kind of getting ready to like step into a new hyper marketing strategy for S3 that I think will probably make it quite big by the end of the year. And the goal is like focusing on like you, the non-technical, like normie, non-technical human out there. Like, how can we get in front of them? And that is kind of the next goal we're about to tackle.
You kind of said, so I read your blog post and you basically said that you want to, you'd like the world to be kind of like realigned to having people follow some mission, right? Or their own mission.
Raise the percentage of people trying to change the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I'm tackling that mission in like three different ways. One, like the astronaut's mission is more people can change the world if they have access to affordable internet. We connect the whole planet. This fixes every single problem. Like less war, better economy, more education, better health. Everything's fixed if everyone has internet or gets more fixed, I should say.
It's a lot better.
So that's one. Second thing is for S3 is to inspire more people to realize that like have the moment that I had when I first came to Astronus, which is like, oh my God, I can change the world too. I want more people to have that experience watching S3. I think right now, Gen Z, millennials and probably Gen Alpha, I specifically focus on Gen Z because that's who I am right now, like is a little bit like, feels like we're screwed. Mm. Like we look at like climate change or how close we are sometimes to thermonuclear war or the way the media makes it look like the economy is stacked against us and you can go on and think we're just done. That's not going to work out. That is a lie. It's a lie from the media. It's a lie from parts or people in the government. It's a lie from entropy. It's just not true. And because the internet can be an echo chamber in certain parts of it, and because our base state as humans is negative bias, which I struggle with all the time, it's really easy to just believe that. And so Gen Z has grown up believing that like, well, how are you gonna fight climate change? Well, you could do direct air capture and make natural gas. You could make artificial volcanoes
how do you do this?
Making some sense, you should interview them. You can create different kinds of molecules to eat petroleum-based polyester, make a new circular kind of material. Fill in the blank. You can do insane things just with technology that can just supersede and cut past government regulatory to make the world a better place. And so anyone that I meet that is just like decel in any way, or like, oh, we're screwed, oh, this isn't going to go well up, it's like, you got to watch S3. You got to like look at what these deep tech companies are doing. You got to realize that it's not just billionaires. Like these are people that are like everyday people for the most part fighting these fights to like make the world a better place. And that is insane. And the media and people don't see this enough. And that's like, that's the mission of S3, is like, look at it, see how it's happening. The reason I do it every week is because that in itself is the quality of like, there's an endless cycle of people building these companies to do this. Like, I can't even cover enough people quickly enough, even though I'm freaking weekly. And like the episode quality suffers greatly because of that. But like, I do it because I know that that weekly cadence is so important for people to see. And so the mission is, yeah, that's the mission there. And the other mission I work on is inspiration. And that's not something like I really have anything like to show yet, but it's ideas like, okay, inspiring more people to go build a future, inspiring people to get, you know, to, you know, get internet. And then like, what does the future actually look like? That's kind of what I'm thinking a lot about right now too. And scheming, cooking, plotting.
The other thing that I just realized is that because I hadn't even thought of this, but because you're doing it with founders before they're, you know, worth $1 billion+,
yeah,
you're actually, you're showing people that are much more like the average person, not the average person, but like the not billionaire person.
It's going to be really awkward when like a bunch of S3 founders become billionaires and then people in the media start being like, ew, billionaire. And it's like, I have footage of them
before they were,
when they were like actually broke.
Yeah.
Like they had nothing. And what got them here is not because they're lucky or rich or have good connections. It's because they had conviction or an idea to change the world, and the market rewarded them for it.
And they just worked relentlessly hard.
Relentless. Subscribe. And they worked, you know, incredibly hard. Yeah, that's the point.
How do you choose which startup to make an episode about? Because I know that you have this process.
I oddly have a sort of low, it's like a low yet high bar to featuring someone on S3. It's also changing.
Okay.
If someone's doing something absurdly ambitious, that is like qualifier one. Qualifier two is like, is it deep tech? So like deep tech is like a little bit of an amorphous term, but to me it means something, if it's got hardware that could count, even if it's just consumer hardware. Sometimes consumer hardware is like way easier to make than other types of hardware. Is it going to have a huge impact on humanity if it works? And it could be software too, but like how much of the software cost is like actually like novel engineering, or like actually like there isn't like there isn't something that exists in this already. You really have to kind of build this from scratch. Any mixture of those things is important. And sometimes I'm not always like trying to pick the biggest of the best of those popular companies. I'm like, does it sit right with my gut to feature them? Do I think they're real? Do I think the people involved like have the right motives? Do I think that the world deserves, or that the world should see this founder and this story?
See what they're trying to build.
See what they're trying to build. Even if it's like, there's some companies who featured them, just like, yeah, they probably have close to zero odds of success because it's so hard. But like, it's still worth it to feature them because even if they fail, that is good that we captured it and showed it because it's an important idea probably. And two, maybe it helps them. Like maybe gives them some like inspiration when they watch it back and hear themselves talking over music, or like someone's like, wow, this inspired me, and then they want to work for them, whatever it may be. So I'm not always sometimes just picking like, do I think the startup's going to succeed? Sometimes it's like, I'll pick startups sometimes thinking like, there's no chance, but like, there's still a chance.
Can you walk me through the process of from start to finish? What does an S3 episode, how does it come together?
So you get connected with the founder somehow. Usually they DM me, I DM them. Someone refers us or connects us. Then we normally, my favorite way of doing it is that I ask them to send me a bunch of stuff in the company that they want to send. They'll send it and I'll like quickly buzz through it. And then I show up for 2.5 hours and we film interviews, some B-roll, and the sit down interview with basically no research. And I used to research a lot before I did S3 episodes. And depending on the, but like if I actually understand the technology to a decent amount, I like going in blind. because like you can really let the person lead you a little bit, which people are better at than like you'd expect. And also you can like once you do like 50 of these things, like you kind of like know, you can like really sense stuff subliminally of like where to pull on the strings and like who to, what to ask, and what the story is. So I find that hyper research for the kind of work that S3 is on a documentary and an interview series isn't necessary. And then filming, we are like really about to change the way we film these things. Like we're really
going to change it.
New camera. We're going to upgrade the quality there, but also like thinking a lot about like what makes S3 unique and what will make S3 unique in like 10 or 100 years. And it's just got to be the most cinematic thing out there. Like every time you watch one of these, like I need to make S3 good to the point where you sit down to watch it and you're like, I have to watch this. It is cinematic as all hell. And it's just like, Jason put too much directorial effort into this for me not to watch this. Like it is simply too good for me to like just scroll by it. I have to watch it. That's where I like to chase. I think it'll take a while to get there. I think it will also, there'll be waves of that. But I do think that is a great goalpost because it's not just another video documentary series. It's not just another interview. It's timeless. It's deeply inspiring. And you know, we want to get so good at it that no one else in the world can do it and that it's just the best.
Yeah. So you are trying to inspire lots and lots of people out there. Who has inspired you the most?
Elon Musk was like a huge inspiration for me. Like I read the Ashley Vance book and then like the Isaacson book. And then I hear stories from people who work with him and I'm just super inspired by that. Every single founder I feature on S3 because it's like, I obsess over them and their company for like a week or two. And everyone's always like, what's your favorite S3 episode? But I actually don't like, I don't have, it's like literally whatever one I'm working on. Cause like I'm trying to make it the best I can and then also tell the story in the most real way. And that experience is so inspiring to like see them tell that story. And like, it's just such an honor to get to like get their raw footage and like make it presentable. Elon Musk was an inspiration. One of my mentors is definitely like Strauss Zelnick. He's the CEO of the parent company of 2K. And he's like very workout minded. And he has this like, I think it's the best like life success idea of all time. Like if you're going to be like, okay, you have to give one thing to one human, like one sentence to maximize their potential for success. What do you want to say to them? So it's such a hard answer. But my answer is know what you want. That's from Strauss. And it's this idea is that if you know what you want, you can accomplish it. And what I love about it is it's one of these sayings, just like the one I have tattooed on me, you only fail when you quit, is that the longer you sit with it, you actually realize there's a lot of depth to it. So knowing what you want and you can achieve it is truly believing that is a realization itself. And then you realize that like actually knowing what you want is really hard, at least for me right now. Some people it's not. For me, it's really hard. Say what's the you only fail when you quit. You only fail when you quit means that you can't fail unless you quit. But then you start to reckon with the fact that sometimes it's good to quit and good to fail. It's weird. Point being, Strauss is like a huge inspiration for me and mentor. Other people that inspire me are definitely like, I feel really like lucky and blessed to have such an incredible group of friends right now in life. I didn't expect to make such good friends through doing S3. I hoped I would have like a cool network and I was like, maybe
how natural it is.
Yeah.
It just happens.
Like you, case in point. But like, I knew I'd probably get invited to some cool parties. Certainly true. But like, I didn't expect to become like best friends with Cameron Schillert of Rangeview or like to become such close friends and like fierce debaters with like Augustus, or to have so much respect for Soren and Olaf, or like, you know, Harris and Zeke. Like, I don't know. All these people really inspire me. It's like the more people I interview, the more people I get inspired by. Yeah.
Which companies do you wish you could have been at the beginning of, you know, the first year or two you're there and you want to do an S3 with that company? Which companies do you wish you could have done an S3 with?
That's such a good question. Obviously, Elon companies. Apple would be the most epic S3. So here's the thing. Here's my argument. For like when people are like, oh, like you picked a bad S3 episode or like, oh, it's a fake company. Do you think Apple looked remotely legit in the beginning?
Yeah.
Like one dude that was a computer nerd and Steve Wozniak, right? But like people today, no one will look at you and be like, Apple would have happened without Jobs. It would not have. No one can argue that.
They pre-sold hardware that they didn't have.
Yeah. And in the early days, it was like, you can imagine like Jobs was just annoying the hell out of Wozniak while he was doing drugs and eating carrots. Yeah, like Jobs had a carrot diet for a long time. Like weird dude. And like, yeah, we featured some weirdos in S3 too, because it's like, that's like, you don't know. But is the idea decent? And the idea of Apple's like, yeah, we want to make great computers and like push this revolution forward. We're going to feature them because you don't know how a company's going to pivot, but you can tell if there's some like energy from the founder. And like Jobs certainly had energy, even if it was probably very chaotic at the time. So like that's a case in point argument for why like when some people just like see the base pitch for a company or hero and they just brush it off. It's like, you haven't studied the game long enough. Like you don't actually understand that like, that's not a, like you have to be patient. And it's like really just like, are they coming back every night? Are they coming back every day to work on this? Other companies, that would be cool. I really want to do like massive companies like S3 too. Like people think it's just startups. And like, especially as we're like getting intro to some bigger companies, yeah. Like, oh, we don't think it's a good fit because like we're not a startup. And I'm like, it's just a name. Like we're going to like, you know, feature big companies too. The idea is that we want all of our little companies to become big companies and keep featuring them. And then we want to go back an ideal like cadence for S3 is like, we feature like the Google DeepMind team.
Yeah.
And then like next week we feature two dudes in a garage. And the week after that, it's like Tesla, all of Tesla manufacturing, period. And then like the week after that, it's like four dudes biohacking. That is the ideal, like go back and forth to remind people that like, there's not so much difference. They're just run by people. Tesla's run by people. Facebook's run by people. The garage is just run by people. Like, yeah. So some of these big companies like Intel or like TSMC would have been cool. Oh my God. If I had to pick one though, it would definitely be Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works.
Really? Oh yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's so cool. But like, I mean, if I had to pick one, I mean, I would pick so many, but like, just like that one would be cool. It's like, yeah. Being, yeah. Skunk Works would be cool. Obviously like no one could watch that video though.
Yeah. You have an insanely long-term view. Longer than, I mean, you can say it, but I've heard very few, even founders, talk about running the same thing or building something for 50 or 100 years.
Yeah.
And how do you think about that?
There's an interesting building a company like being like, that's going to happen. I'm not necessarily saying that with this three, like, but I'm treating it like that for now. And I currently plan to. I think it's important because it like hedges bets and like checks against your motives. So like if I go on like YouTube, which I often do, right? And I see like the most clickbaity, crappy YouTuber blow up overnight, and I'm just like, it's depressing to like pour in what I pour in and then see like some crappy person get lucky with the algorithm or make a more hooky thing for whatever the current zeitgeist trend of like editing is right now. Remember that like, is that gonna matter in 100 years? And most of the time it won't. Once in a while, that person will be Mr. Beast. But then like even Mr. Beast, like his videos like—
They've evolved.
Well, his videos suck, right?
Like you don't like his videos?
Well, here we are. We're saying it's like on paper, is there any substance to his videos, especially his early work? It's like, no, it's like, no. He's literally trying to go viral. And so early on, I hated Mr. Beast. And then once you realize it's like, wait a minute, he is obsessed with becoming the best YouTuber in the world. It's like, I no longer hate him. It's like, okay, now he's like transitioned out of that. This is commonly why I don't have much respect for content creators unless they create content for like more than a few years. Because it's like everyone's early content's going to suck or it's going to be really like corny and following trends. But then eventually you'll see like, who are they really? And like Mr. Beast has proven he just wants to be the best. And so now it's inspiring and that's a cool story I can get behind. Like, but early days, I was like, this is silly. He's just like clickbaiting. And then like, you know, like, but like he actually really cares about just being the best. And it's like, cool. And that's what you hear about. Great. So for me, like, it'd be really easy to like change the way I do S3 to go more viral quicker, but, and there's definitely changes I need to make and I'm too slow with some of these changes, like way too slow. But overall, I look at the future and like, the vision is like inspiring a ton of people to be more active about changing the world. And like, I don't want anyone else in Gen Z to ever accept or feel like, or just accept status quo.
Hopelessness.
Yeah, accept status quo of what like older generations or what problems we face are. Like we should always have an attitude of like, we can fix it. And like, I want to help instill that with S3 and introduce our generation to more people who are building that, who are our age and older too. Like one of my favorite episodes
that we haven't released yet is this dude is like in his 60s. And he's like, his whole life he worked as an oil executive. And like one day he like just realized that like he didn't like the impact that was causing, and he wanted to create something to offset it. So he did. And he's like 60 with a new deep tech company. It's doing incredibly well. It will change the world. It's so stealth, we can't even release the episode yet. But it's insane what they're going to do. And like people are going to freak out once they hear about it because they're like, oh my God, my business is gone. But theirs is like going to make the world a great place and save a ton of emissions. And like point being, it's like whether you're, you know, a 19-year-old or a you know, 67-year-old, it's like that's super inspiring. I want more people to feel that way. And so there's like thinking about like what will society look like in 100 years and like realizing that actually it's just like a net result of like the loudest voices in the room staying around the longest. So people like Beth or Guillaume, like talking about this idea of EAC and this idea of like making society better through increasing technology, building the future, kind of the S3 style, like build the future and make it better, make the future better by building it or solving problems. It's like that's how our best efforts now are what we're going to get 100 years down the line, or 10 or 20, 50 years down the line. And so my view too is like also like if even one of these companies is successful, and I know way more than one is going to be successful in S3, I can feel it. Can you feel the music? That people are going to want footage of the early days. And like, you know, probably 30% of the footage that makes it to an S3 episode, it's only 30% of what's shot. There's all this extra archival footage that startups sometimes ask for various reasons, or like one day, like with their permission, we can give out to documentarians or other editors or people, because like it's important that they have this early day footage. So I always tell people, like sometimes like I'm like, let's do an S3 with the founder. And they're like, no, like we want to wait until we raise, until we announce, or until we have this cool piece of hardware. It's like, we're going to do follow-up episodes. Like
it's okay.
Like it's okay. Do it early. Trust me.
How do you actually optimize what you're creating today for timelessness?
It's two part. One is like creating the best thing I can today. Same idea I said earlier was like, am I leaving it all in the court? And per episode, no. Like most S3 episodes sucked to me, and it really actually breaks my heart. Those are really bad.
What does that mean?
They're just like the quality is not good. Like I could do so much better if I had more time, but there's quality in the consistency of doing it weekly. And I realize that. And so I'm making a episode quality sacrifice for the quality of the S3 mission being weekly is really important. It's more important than the actual quality of the episode, which is just an ego thing for me.
It's to tell more stories.
To tell more stories right now. On this weekly cadence is way more important than like making the episodes perfect. Like episode quality right now is like 3 or 4 out of 10 in my eyes. It's really bad. And like eventually we'll get it better probably, but like that's not really what's important now. What's important is this cadence. And like, ironically, I realized that the story of me breaking my neck to like do this every week is actually an important story for other people too. Because then as I keep doing that, people realize like, this guy's killing himself. Why? And then they'll look into why and like get a cool answer. And then they'll go watch the episodes and then they'll get inspired. This next stage of marketing, I'm realizing for a while, it's like, why doesn't technology break into the mainstream more? Like the average Gen Z normie, quote unquote normie. I hate saying that, it's so offensive. Why? And I realize it's because I think it's like, unless you like believe that you are smart enough or believe that you can understand some technology, you don't really care about it. You're just like, I brush it off, like, right? But if you can understand it or like kind of like grok it, then you're like, oh, cool. And so what most Gen Z people can understand is art. And they have a deep appreciation for this. Like videos on TikTok and Instagram becoming more cinematic. Gen Z always has a really great music taste, like core music taste. It's actually good. And so I realized that like the story for growing S3 very big on Reels and TikTok and to greater Gen Z is actually the story of me telling the story. And so it's not going to be like me. I hate that. It's just going to be about like kind of anonymous filmmaker dude telling the story, like deeply kind of killing himself week over week to like flying around the world, staying up late editing, like, you know, cornfield chase by Hans Zimmer playing over like filming. And then it cuts to like the cool shot. That's the story. And that's what's going to buy people in to become, S3 a massive force. That will close out stage one of S3 and lead us to stage two.
What is stage two?
The Nike of technology.
The Nike of technology.
That sounds so stupid.
Actually, no, it doesn't. It doesn't, because if you listen to early Steve Jobs, he said Nike doesn't sell shoes. It celebrates great athletes and it celebrates great athletics.
So before Nike, sports wasn't that like cool.
Yeah,
it was just sports were awesome. People liked it, but like Nike
made sports like cool and sexy. Like, have you seen what basketball players like looked like before Nike?
Oh,
dude, they looked geeky and weird. Yeah. And like so many sports like looked weird. And then Nike like basically was like, we're going to like make everyone's like, we're going to make everyone look cool. And S3's going to do that for technology. We're going to make it as cool as it deserves to be.
It's, you want to have that same transition.
Yeah. We want to make, and again, I don't actually care if S3 is the thing that does it. I just want to be part of it or help it. You know, I'm finding more and more in life that I actually care less about if I'm the one that does it. I just like want, need it to happen. But like,
no one else is doing it.
Yeah. But like what I'm realizing is like, we're going to like this summer, like later this year, then next year, oh my God. But like this year we're going to do like really cool merch that like you would just normally wear, like would look cool. The average person, the average like artistic person, it's that Malcolm Gladwell thing, the skaters would wear it. Mm. You know, I think it's called, the Malcolm Gladwell book where he talks about like that. It's like if skaters are like this kind of alt current crowd will wear it, then it's cool. We're going to make stuff like that. And people fall in love with it and then fall in love with the story of anonymous film dude filming these companies and ensuring they're like, wait a minute, technology has humanity? It does. And like, that's the story. That's the kind of phase two is like, all right, let's go like get people wearing cool looking stuff. Like, look, like I'm wearing the Range V merch, and the Range V merch is like pretty cool. There's some things I would like probably change about the design, but overall it's sick. And like, we want to make a ton of merch that's like using some of the company's products we feature in the creation of the merch. And also it's just like, it's not even merch. It's just like Nike. It's just like you wear it because it's cool and you like the way it looks and makes you feel. And that's what we want to do for tech and like bring back the humanity to it and let people feel empowered and like actually believe that they too can go and build the future.
Yeah. I imagine that you would actually have this. What's your favorite 10-year period from US history?
I'm going to say it. Early Silicon Valley is actually not all that cool. Like people are like, oh my God, like early Mark Zuckerberg, early PayPal is so cool. Yeah. Like, yes, obviously it's kind of cool. But I'm saying it as a deep cut nerd. This generation is so much cooler. We got a dude with a mullet who's going to make it rain. We got a dude who's like doing weekly documentaries about these companies. We got people like using microbes to eat petroleum to turn it into new. Like, are you kidding me? And like, by the end of this decade, these people are going to be as cool as the actors and actresses of old. Like, we are going to win and we're going to make technology as cool as it's always deserved to be and not this like evil, like mysterious force. Like, we're going to humidify it. I don't mean that's a word. And so I think like, I don't know. I just think about all my friends that are building the future with good hearts and good intentions, who are all individually cool people and so different and diverse. And like, that is fucking cool. Like, so yeah, like right now is the coolest point in US history. And it's not even halfway done yet.
What's the hardest thing you've overcome?
I very much believe that like the hard, like, you know, hard things you go through, like just make you that much more stronger. I say that and then sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't want to get out of bed. Like I'm a little sleepy and I'm like, you went through so many hard things. Like, why aren't you getting out of bed? like, why are you being lazy? But I think the one that kind of comes to mind is kind of that time when I was like going to leave 2K the first time and going to start Joyride on my own. I thought I had everything figured out. Like I just thought I knew everything I needed to know. I was so confident. I wasn't even cocky. That's what was weird about it. I had the grit, I had the vision, the ideas, and the execution. And I was just wrong on almost everything and had the wrong ideas and everything and didn't learn quick enough, wasn't resilient enough, and failed basically. And this was hard, it was during COVID. This led to me being in not great place mentally and like, it was very, very hard. And like, I'm really happy it happened because it had worked. I'd be like, you know, a successful music video director or in the music industry, which if you want to do that, great. But like, I realized it's just not for me. And I'm happy that that didn't work out. And a lot of my life, I've struggled with like, what am I to do here on earth with my time? That's something I still struggle with. And that is the hardest thing for me. I don't know why it means so much to me to know this or to think I know it or to have this feeling. But this has been like sort of my lifelong battle with myself.
it has eaten me up. It sort of continues to in some ways. And it's iterative is my best guess, is that like you just kind of keep making motion and keep moving forward. And like through that, you get clarity. But that lack of confidence or ill lack of confidence or overconfidence throughout life has definitely led me to at times feel like really not great. And that can manifest into personal things, relational things, business things.
Jason, thank you so much.
Ty, thank you.
Loved it.